And I'm happy to introduce the second speaker, Manu Prakash from Stanford. He is a professor of bioengineering and other things there. If you Google his name, three things come out at the very first page. One is innovator, another is curiosity-driven science, and the third one is mysterious foldscope. So I encourage you to Google and see what all those things mean. And I'm sure it will be an absolutely fascinating talk. Manu, please.
Can everybody hear me at the back? So first of all, thank you for this amazing gathering. This is, again, for like many of us, the first time we're getting out to get together in an in-person conference. I'm going to talk about recreational biology. And the context of this comes from me trying to figure out what the hell do we actually do in the lab. Many of you know the field of recreational mathematics. Does everybody here know Martin Gardner? Okay, actually, less of you know. I wish more of you would actually know him. He's basically a writer who wrote about the most remarkable mathematical findings from all kinds of abstract fields. But the principle of recreational mathematics is you should be able to explain the question in the simplest possible language that anybody on the street could understand, and they can have sometimes remarkable hidden mathematics behind. And I think sometimes when we are thinking about the types of questions we like to ask, we try to stick to that principle. If you get completely bored out of this talk, here is a recreational mathematics question. Take a toroid, see how many pieces can you cut it with three planes. So before I begin, I get a chance to work with a remarkable group of people, so I'm going to mention their names along the way, but it's really their silliness and playfulness that really leads to many of these sets of things we are able to do. Okay, so I think we will pose some of the questions now. And the framework that I like to use often enough is in the context of paradoxes, so I'll bring up those paradoxes along the way because it's a very good tool to understand. And if some of you have read the last phase of what Max Delbruck was doing in his life, he really clearly shared this vision of thinking about paradoxes in biology. We're going to do it in the context of biodiversity. To really be able to building up on what Christy said is an incredible number of organisms do what they do, and we truly are at the beginning of how to ask these sets of questions. So I began my life making and thinking about mechanical computers, so I'm going to begin the sets of questions in the non-living world for a second. And I think most of you have actually seen now a million times this video. I'm not even going to play that video, but I do want to play another video, which is as a teaser, that sometimes when you're thinking about chemotaxis, can non-living systems do complex chemotaxis? So I'll just play this video for a second for some of you who might not have seen this. This is an experiment that you can all do. This is a glass slide that's clean and food coloring. That's it. There is nothing else to it. Water, food coloring, and they show motility. They show the types of motilities. This is an engine, so we haven't invented a perpetual motion machine. There is actually an evaporation engine inside these. And often enough, I have wondered about this notion of when we see similarities in physical systems, how far should we draw our analogies? You know, these sets of systems chase each other. You can encode a sense of identity so they can detect who they are. And in the true spirit of paradoxes, I'm not going to tell you how this system works. You can read about it. Or even more so, go to the kitchen and actually do this experiment yourself. But somehow, these little drops of water are actually communicating at long distances. They're generating signals. And because I know Robert is in the talk, in the last line of our paper, we had mentioned something that these droplets not only can talk to each other, they can talk to self by purely reflection. So they also see their own reflection in the mirrors. And I was just delighted to read many of the papers that came about around cells seeing around the corner. So let's dive into the living world now. So this is going to be a lot more wilder than cleaner analogies that I mentioned. And the perspective that we will take here is Also thinking about the ecology and the environments that these cells show these types of motilities. I think many of you have seen these sets of paintings. This was the very first time a rhino was represented ever in literature, except the artist had never actually met a rhino. And you can see he got roughly some things right, but most of the things wrong. Rhinos don't have armor plates. You might meet a rhino in a zoo, or you might meet them in the wild. And I think we should be careful when we are thinking about behavior in the context of questions to really think about ecology as well, which I'll touch upon. So here is the menu for today. I'm going to briefly mention this notion of neuroscience without neurons. I hope I'm not offending any neuroscientists here, but frankly, this idea of behavior and computation is far wider than what we think in terms of thinking about building systems that are just built out of neurons. I have an example of what we've been working on, which can be described as the longest migration, cell migration on this planet. So maybe I'll touch upon that. And maybe I'll close with a puzzle in topology. So I think to begin in terms of thinking about neuroscience without neurons, let me first jump to give you an example of this. And I am jumping my slides here, which will become clear. Let's start with diversity. This is a little bit of a menu of what Christy showed. We will focus on one of these systems. This is Lacrimaria oler, one of our favorite single cells in the lab. Very, very painful to keep alive and grow. And this is work which was first started by a postdoc in the lab, Scott Coyle, who now has his lab and now continued with Ellie, who was a graduate student, Deepak, who was a graduate student in the lab, who just graduated in Hong Chuan. Why is this cell interesting? We caught this in a pond when I was actually just fold scoping, and we saw this behavior. This is real time. Here is a single cell that's dancing around in real time, and you might wonder what it's actually doing. Let's just take a closer look. And you might be a little bit surprised. Seems like, we will call this neck. The neck seems to extend. Let's watch it a little bit closer. You can see it's driven by cilia. The body sometimes moves, sometimes the body remains stationary, and it just shows this behavior. But the remarkable aspect of this behavior becomes clear when you watch this. It's a predator. And poor little ciliate, the other ciliate, and you'll see what just happens. Remarkably, the cell transforms itself and gobbles up the other cell. This is all real time. Now, the question that arises is, what is controlling all of this dynamics, right? You might ask, where is the brain? And actually, it turns out, we stepped in ciliary biology and ciliate biology in general. There was 20, 30 years of a setback when anatomists at that time started finding neuronal-like projections inside single cells, and this is a historical context, and then later on people realized that that was all bogus. But behavior still has to be encoded. And to give you the environmental context now, this is that same cell. Look at the cell. The cell is only around 30 micron, and it has a projection right there. This is a single cell, single membrane extended all the way to around a millimeter. This is one of the largest strain and strain rates in a single cell that we've actually ever observed. So I'm not going to touch on, there's a lot going on here. There is ciliary dynamics, there is actually a cytoskeletal dynamics, there is membrane constraints, but I'll give you a hint in terms of how started to building with simple analogies, we can start to understand where that complex behavior might be coming from. So the first thing we do is we really quantify these systems very carefully, and I'm going to skip all of this to just give you a context that you can map much of this behavior in the context of search. So when I plot these sets of projections of where the tip is, you can actually see that the cell is searching around its environment. And you can break some of that search in the context of shape modes. And then you can start seeing that somehow the cell sitting at a place can search its environment. There are no blind spots. And what possibly class of mechanisms could actually encode this? And the simplest behavioral context that ends up happening is the cell extends and retracts, and much of that is driven by ciliary dynamics. You will see that the reversal dynamics will lead to retraction, and extension is the cilia moving in the right direction. You can map that from flow. You can actually see this in the flow structures itself. Extension, contraction, extension, contraction. We can also actually map the calcium dynamics to this to really also show that much of these sets of reversals are calcium driven. But here is what I want to, you to take in terms of thinking about the simplest way. If search is a very fundamental process, it happens at molecular scales, it happens at foraging in animals, how would you encode search in a system like this? And I'm thinking of this in the first context of a zero information environment. And we started asking ourselves a very, very simple question. If I was to take an elastic filament and just apply activity that turns on and off in a periodic manner, so you can see I'm defining a time scale associated with that, extension, compression, could we get some surprises? And just for the modeling folks, we essentially do this in an active filament kind of a model, and I've simplified this to a perspective where the activity is only at the tip. We can actually do the activity to be distributed as well, but some really interesting surprises come out of this. We can non-dimensionalize the activity there, essentially by dividing that by the elasticity of the system. And effectively, there are a couple of timescales we can write. I want to just jump to the movies itself. And an important distinction I'm making here first is I'm not including sensing in this model. I just want to see what does periodic activity on this geometry actually look like. And the first surprise came when we started really looking at this from a very periodic deterministic context. So first of all, we can do the elastohydrodynamics of this, you can see, and then these sets of filaments start doing some really fun things. This is not your typical Euler buckling, and I'll just mention that in a second of why that is, and you can see that dynamics play out in single cells and try to make your analogies. But now here is the fun part. So you watch this in the context of just periodic activity first. What you're looking at is the dimensionless activity at the bottom, 64, 85, I'm just scaling it. Extension, compression of these cycles. But actually, what these are periods of an oscillator. You can see the 2 period, the 6 period, and the 10 period. And now watching that movie, try to figure out what the periodicity is, for example, that 10 period. Try doing this sooner, otherwise it'll actually show up in the video. And very soon, what looks like random is actually incredibly periodic. Just watch that last video on the top. 1, 2, 3, 4, it's counting. Only with single activity number that's completely deterministic. And of course, you know, many of you who think about dynamical systems would think, yes, that, you know, that is possible. There's a sense of complexity in this, but this is doable. But suddenly, as I change my parameter just a little bit in the elasticity or the associated activity, something really remarkable pops out, which is the system becomes chaotic. And I'll show that in a second. You are very close to the same sets of numbers. I'm going to just drag this. And you'll start seeing that the search at this point starts becoming quite comprehensive in volume. And in terms of information, the way you should think about it is as soon as you can forget where you were and the time scale at which you forget, as soon as you decorrelate where you were, you actually create a random search. Now, we can really quantify this in the context of this entire phase space. We can map this by activity number and the dimensionless activity time scale. And you see this beautiful parameter. Below a certain critical activity, you don't actually induce buckling. There is no search. We start seeing odd periods, even periods, and then all of these aperiodic parameters scattered in a very complex way. So we started thinking, and again, all of that is correlated to how quickly you search. And we started asking ourselves, there might be a simple way to actually visualize this. So for some of you who work on dynamical systems, we took this, the first 3 modes itself, so rather than focusing on this, which is very complex, you can just look at the limit cycle, which is now plotted in 3 dimensions with the first 3 modes. And you can see that it's actually quite periodic, although very complex, Trajectory follows directly that class of pattern. And as you start changing these sets of activities, you start going away from these limit cycles. Now, the reason this is fascinating is coming from a very classical idea in mechanics, which is called follower force, which is your compressive force in the reversal of the cilia is actually constrained by your shape itself. So the direction of that force, it is not Euler buckling, because that is the direction of the force is never kept normal to the base plate. And you can see right there that the force follows the shape. And this is why the system has actually been studied in the past for stability of rockets. And my most fun example is if some of you end up turning the faucet of your garden hose, this is exactly what might happen in a context of a follower force here for an elastic structure. And actually, it had been shown for these class of systems where there is no periodicity that these sets of systems become chaotic. And essentially, we were able to show for dynamical follower force systems, we are able to prove that these systems are chaotic. And you will see that in a second. You are watching, I think, around 10 filaments that have been started almost very close to each other. And very soon, they will actually diverge. And effectively, again, it's still a bounded state space of search. But at that same time, at any given moment now, you'll start seeing right there. So at that, what you were watching was actually dynamics of 10 filaments right on top of each other. And suddenly, you see very quickly, it exponentially goes away. And this encodes search. Now, I'm going to skip much of this because I'm running out of time. We can prove that it's chaotic. We can write down an iterative map for the system and actually derive the bifurcation diagrams. But most interestingly, we can actually program this behavior. So now if you were to think about, you know, just from a context of neuroscience, some of you might have followed rate encoding. Rate encoding changes neuronal dynamics in terms of frequency. So you can take the context of frequency. Let's just focus on that filament shape, in which low frequency, high frequency activity put in the system allows it to do a local search and a global search simultaneously. So what that would mean is if I was to play this in the context of what we call homing, we can do frequency modulation, and then let's watch local and global search here. So that is the time period of activity. And you notice what I'm doing. I'm playing a trick with that, is to give it shorter time scales and longer time scales for reversal. And you can clearly see that pattern that the activity is correlated in a given point. That's a local search, while that suddenly, if you change the frequency, the filament goes to a new location. This is just one way of programming. And now, of course, the problem or the cell biology of this is far more complex, but it's actually very important to start from some very fundamental basic ideas of what might be going on. We started looking at this in the context of the cytoskeleton, and then we discovered the second surprise, which is the cytoskeleton of this system is incredible. It is, it's a helical structure. It is not a woven basket. Sometimes people have seen this as an object and thought that this is a woven basket. This is actually a Z projection. That's why it looks like this. The system has a chirality. Ellie in the lab has been working on both mathematical models of this type of architecture. And we just recently discovered why this architecture is actually fundamental to that strain and strain rate I was talking about. All the membrane and the microtubule structure is stored when the cell is in a contracted state, and it gets spooled out through this transition zone, because when we write down the energetics of this, we can show that there is a transition point. Now, Ellie worked very hard to get essentially 3D reconstructions using TEMs. And one of the surprising discoveries that we actually also made, that those microtubule structures are not just single microtubules, they are doublets of folded structures in the membrane. And this answers finally the question of where does the membrane come from. So this is an example of a curved origami where at every one of those sites that you actually see, and you can see the basal bodies right there, there is the doublets, but those lines that you see actually have bundles of microtubules attached to the membrane. And this set of an architecture allows the cell to actually deploy a massive amount of filament or a neck without popping off. Now, I'm just going to leave you guys with just some drug perturbations to tell you that there is a lot more going on. So this is one example. You know, we've used many different types of calcium chelators. We can increase the calcium concentrations, we can decrease them, and we can make the cell both very sick. So what we have done right now is shut down its capacity to retract the filament. There is centrin in the system, and so the filaments actually contract as well. And you can see that rather than extending and contracting, the neck folds and unfolds in this very peculiar way, which over time looks, the cells look quite sick. But what we have done is just turned off its capacity to actually retract. Now, there are many drug perturbations that we do and map the context of behavior, but I think I'm going to skip this because I am running out of time. So maybe in the last few minutes, you can tell me what you might want to hear. I could tell you about the longest cell migration in the world, or I could tell you about the context of how cilia coordinate in multicellular systems. So actually, is there a preference? Longest cell migration or multicellular? Longest cell migration, okay. Actually, it's related to climate change, so that might be another. But before I jump into that, I think the thing that I do want to mention is we have recently discovered this notion of what we are calling a mechanical brain. Because this is published, it's good. You can see this, it's a trilogy with a graduate student, a remarkable student in the lab, Matt Stormbull, where we actually describe how millions of cilia can actually coordinate behavior and how you encode information in millions of cilia together. And much of this has led us to really think about this perspective of neuroscience without without neurons. Okay, let's jump to the longest migration on the planet. This is work with two postdocs, Adam Larson and Rahul in the lab, and also what we call a gravity machine, which will become clear, which is a much larger team in the lab. But for this perspective, I want you to kind of take a look at that painting on the left. I want you to imagine, many of you have been to Grand Canyon, except imagine standing right next to the ocean and seeing a chasm being cut in the ocean. So you could actually see what is in the depth patterning of the ocean. And what has been known since the World War is actually life migrates kilometers across the vertical axis in the ocean. This is one of the examples, is diel migration. You can see this as an animation. All of this has ever been observed only in a population dynamics. And for the very first time, we've been able to observe this in the context of single cells. Now, why is this important? Which is, you know, sometimes if some of you go diving, you can see this is the density of life and cell motility that you should be thinking about. This is real-time video of the amount of what the hell is going on in the ocean. This is what we don't understand, and this is why many of our climate models essentially fail, because we fail to include biology of the ocean. And so for some of you who worry about this, the reason it's important to understand is that the ocean is one of the largest sequestration mechanisms. If the ocean carbon sequestration was turned off, our carbon number from the atmosphere will go from a 400 to 600 parts per million instantaneously. And the mechanism that drives much of this carbon capture is how life sinks down in the bottom of the ocean. Now, for some of you who think about sinking, this is a fairly straightforward context. You can think about this from a Stokesian dynamics. As another puzzle, you can ask yourself, if you drop a penny from the height or a diatom being 100 micron and a penny being a couple millimeters or centimeter, how long will it take? Most cells usually in the ocean are, the cytoplasmic density is a little bit heavier. And the context of this happening across the length scale is that there is a patterning along the vertical gradient. Now, the question we started asking ourselves is motility possible even for systems that do not have any appendages? No cilia, no flagella, but also no substrate. So gliding motility is also out what Christy was talking about. So how the hell does a cell, now what the hell cell do? And we were out of the coast of Hawaii, and we actually caught this cell, Pyrocystis noctiluca. Many of you have been at MBL, you've all played in bioluminescence. We caught these cells 200 meters deep in the water. They have no mechanism for motility, and this had been also described by Swift in 1976, but this distribution. One of the challenges of studying multi-scale problems is if a cell is migrating 100 meters, I need a microscope that's 100 meters to be able to observe it. And this is the trick that we came up with, because that's not possible, which is to put cells in treadmills, which from the context of a cell, the environment is essentially as if it was in an open vertical column of water. But so you can see these are large wheels. These are microscopes that are tilted 90 degrees. And we can write down the mathematics of this, that the hydrodynamics works out. We've been taking these instruments out at sea. So this is that cell. This is the migration. That's the machine that's essentially emulating the ocean. And this is what these data sets look like. I enjoy watching these because this is actually 500 miles off any coast, data being collected at single cell migrations of a cell that was just collected a few minutes ago from, say, 75 meters deep in the ocean. This was a problematic day because we got hit by a storm, but that's another story. So what we found is that these cells are actually migrating along the vertical column. And long story short, the way they do this is absolutely remarkable. When you watch these cells, when they divide, they can, in a matter of 10 minutes, inflate like a giant balloon. Now, that should be very puzzling and disturbing for cell biologists, because you would realize that you've diluted the cytoplasm multifold, and no biochemistry should actually work. And here's the trick. They actually use topology to be able to do this. So one of the things that we discovered is when we look at these cells, we find that the cytoplasm is actually in this membrane net. And what is expanding and collapsing is a giant vacuole that is topologically linked with this set of a structure. We can prove this with TEM. And one of the fascinating aspects of this is we can map the cell cycle finally to the depths that we find them. So what the cells are doing is using a buoyancy engine by taking in water. Once we look at the transcriptome, we found 7 novel aquaporins in the system. So they have the capacity to be able to take water in and out to be able to map where they are in the ocean and use that buoyancy engine for motility. Now, I'm actually absolutely out of time. But one of the things I just want to mention is that there is a mathematical framework of what we've been calling a gravitational trap. Because all life evolved on the planet with gravity being always present, there is actually a critical parameter number. And when we map those sets of critical parameter numbers, we find why cytoplasmic density is what it is. So this is a phase space of cytoplasmic density and the gravitational trap. If you are to ever fall on the right side of that red line, evolutionarily, over many generations, your cell will disappear. This number, this idea of where does cytoplasmic density actually comes from, it might actually come from the survival in the context of a gravitational trap. I'm going to end here, but one of the things I want to lead with you is paradoxes. So it turns out that diatoms by themselves are also not passive, even when they are completely suspended. This is the most jaw-dropping movie that Deepak and I have ever captured. This was in Puerto Rico. This is a centric diatom that we caught around the coast. You're watching a cell essentially sink. Keep an eye on the time. The cell is sinking, and it's as if a rock that was sinking could suddenly float itself. It's suspense. It is not connected to any boundaries. All boundaries are many millimeters away. The cell has the capacity in 100 milliseconds to change its cell density by 10%. Look at the track right there. It's as if it's just frozen. It can levitate. And one of the things that we have forgotten sometimes is cell motility, even in mechanisms and systems that have absolutely no known appendages like cilia. And it's incredibly important because diatoms, of course, have to be distributed in the photic zone. So I'm going to stop here. If some of you are interested in behavioral context, we are trying to create, at this point we have data sets for around 150 species collected from the ocean, and all of this data set we'll be openly making available on this website called gravitymachine.org. And one of the perspective of this is to, even before we try to understand, we should really map what behavior looks like for cells in an ecosystem. I am already out of time, so I will stop, and if there is any moment, I can take some questions.